Morning, everybody. Seated. Our first case this morning is case number 64604, U.S. Home Corporation versus Medina. Mr. Kane for the appellate, Mr. Schenick for the respondent.
Chief, before we get started, just have one question for the attorneys. I mean, we did get supplemental authorities in here. The United States Supreme Court decided the case of Kindred Nursing Centers versus Clark on May 15, 2017. So what impact, if any, this case has on this particular one will be interesting. Hopefully both parties will address and let us know. Okay.
Reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
May it please the court. My name is Greg King. I'm counsel for U.S. Home, the developer whose motions to compel arbitration was denied by the lower court. It was just over a year ago that Mr. Schenick and I were here before the court arguing similar issues regarding arbitration having to do with purchase and sell agreements. And in fact, one of the purchase and sell agreements at issue in this case is the same purchase and sell agreement that was at issue in that appeal. And so I thought that I would focus on issues that are different in this case, namely the issues relating to the arbitration agreement in the CC&Rs. The homeowners have raised the question of whether or not it's appropriate to include an arbitration agreement in CC&Rs. The answer, we believe, is absolutely. NRS 116-2105 states that the declarant can put any other matters in the CC&Rs can put any other matters the declarant considers appropriate. That begs the question, can the declarant really put anything it wants into the CC&Rs? Let me step back and remind the court that NRS 16, through NRS 16, the legislator, legislation adopted the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act. And I think it's safe to assume that the people that drafted that model act and the committees that vetted over the language included in the act, they were well aware of this language that provided broad discretion to the declarant to include what it feels is appropriate into the CC&Rs. And we can assume the legislature, the Nevada legislature, when adopting the act, they too were well aware of this provision. I think that the Pinnacle case, a case that we cite throughout our papers, the California Supreme Court, which dealt with a similar issue having to do with arbitration agreements in CC&Rs, I think it put forth the correct analysis. And that analysis is, as long as that provision is not reasonable, then it's appropriate to put a provision in the CC&Rs that the declarant feels is appropriate. And then the Pinnacle Court, the California Supreme Court, went on to conduct a procedural and a substantive unconscionability analysis. So I think that standard is what we should apply here. One thing that I'm very confident in is that it is not unreasonable to include in CC&Rs a provision that provides for resolving disputes between the parties that are subject to the CC&Rs, the declarant, the homeowners, and the association. And in fact, in light of the public policy that created by the federal FAA and created by the Nevada State Court and the Nevada State Legislature, not only is it not inappropriate, I think it's something that should be encouraged to include arbitration provisions within CC&Rs.
CC&R is an interesting document for most of us. As we sit there and you have a mountain of paper in front of you and you start signing off your name, I guess the question I have is notice to that buyer that that's even there in the CC&Rs. Because normally they're told to read the contract. They're very seldom told to really read the CC&Rs. So is this something that is we can consider hidden, or we should take it face value? And as to your earlier comment about our legislature, without getting too deeply into that little issue since they're still in session right now trying to sort out the world, did in fact the hearings on adoption of this show that they went through the Uniform Act and were cognizant of what was contained in that Uniform Act, or was it just presented with no history and so it just got approved and we are only to assume they understand what they approved?
If I answer your question, I haven't reviewed the record to review what the Nevada legislature, what they reviewed when they adopted that model act. With regard to the procedural aspects, I acknowledge that that is an issue. It's a potential problem whenever you have CCNRs. That is something that is critical to the workings of CCNRs. You can't have a common interest community in which the homeowners can raise objections about, I don't have to pay an assessment. I don't have to pay a fee because I wasn't aware of that.
The basic part of this, even though we are in fact talking about common interest communities, and that's the box we're putting this issue into, we still have the buy and sell agreement as to the individual owner, and we can't forget that as we're analyzing this problem as to what they signed or didn't sign and what they were aware of. I guess the other question I have too, even though you've not dealt with this, is that one of the things that struck me was that neither party really exercised discovery. And so we almost have a blank canvas and are to assume certain things based on jurisprudence and other jurisdiction, but not knowing how the facts are actually related in this matter. Should we just reverse this and send it back so discovery can be done so that we know that you meet certain things like FAA applies because it's actually interstate commerce. We have nothing in the record that indicates one way or the other. I realize the developers are from another state and so on and so forth, but there's nothing really in the record that demonstrates a number of these things that are pertinent to our review in this case.
Okay. Justice Douglas, you've raised a number of issues. Let me try to address them as best as I can. So, with regard to discovery, I think that cuts against the homeowners. The homeowners have the burden of presenting substantial evidence to the lower court if they want to have the arbitration agreements not enforced on procedural grounds. And of the 40 sets of homeowners in this case, not one presented a declaration. Not one presented any statement saying that they were unaware of the arbitration provision, that they were confused because the arbitration provision was hidden somewhere in the CCNRs, that they were confused by the arbitration agreement. We don't know if these homeowners are attorneys and bankers and sophisticated business people. We don't know. But the developers shouldn't be penalized. That's their burden to show that there's a procedural unconscionability that's happened. They haven't presented a single declaration with regard to the CCNR motion to compel arbitration. That's on the homeowners. With regard to the FAA, I don't think we need to conduct discovery to determine whether or not the FAA is triggered in this case. Remember, the standard is whether or not there's a contract that evidences a transaction that relates to interstate commerce, involving interstate commerce.
There's differing viewpoints on that.
Okay. Well, the quoting the FAA itself, it says it applies whenever a written provision in a contract evidences a transaction involving interstate commerce. It's our position that the CCNRs absolutely evidence a transaction that involve interstate commerce. If you look at the recital B of the CCNRs, it says the declarants, we propose to develop a planned community and to convey the real property within the project. At the outset, the transactions being contemplated by the CCNRs are the development and construction of a community and the selling of the units within that community.
And where is that community located?
Where is
the community located?
It's in southern, here in Nevada.
It's Nevada real property. It's a Nevada home. Get into CCNRs and application because materials and things of that nature. But the record really doesn't show that. We are to assume, that word assume gets in the way. And I was, as I was looking at this morning and going through the case law, the premise that you take a lot of, some jurisdictions just jump to that. They say, well, we have this home, the builders from out of state, and they must be using interstate materials, so therefore FAA applies. But there's other case law that says, guess what? You need to show that. It needs to be demonstrated if you want to put that into play.
Respectfully, I believe the other case law has to deal with the transfer of real property, not with the construction.
But the interstate commerce, as I said, I mean, way back in the day, and I'm old, so for some reason they taught us that real property was unique and it belonged, it was local,
right.
It wasn't federal. So we get into the only thing that's interstate commerce, so to speak, is the developer and possibly lumber or aluminum studs or whatever they happen to use to construct the property.
I think if you focus on the language of the CC&Rs, it indicates that it's more than just selling real property to these homeowners. It's contemplating the construction of homes within that project using materials that are in commerce. And as this court said in the Tallman case, if it's in commerce, it triggers the commerce clause. Paragraphs 1.29 talk of the CC&Rs, talk about improvements to be constructed. Paragraph 7.3 of the CC&Rs say, they talk about residential dwellings will be constructed. I can cite three or four or five more paragraphs that show.
The things that you just said, unless they specifically identify the residential property to be constructed, property, local, property doesn't go into interstate commerce. Contrast. Whether or not the improvements that are being added come from interstate. Myself personally, I don't know this day. Unless somebody tells me otherwise. But I throw that out because that's a concern. We've gotten off to the races, and we haven't gone back to the fundamentals about, is this truly interstate commerce? And that, your first part, whose burden is it? I accept what you're saying on that.
Okay, and I would just encourage the court to look at the case law that we cite throughout the country, which suggests that when you're constructing homes, interstate commerce is triggered. And it would be impossible to create a home here in Nevada using wood, tile, concrete, all came from here in Nevada. You have to get that outside the jurisdiction. Well, I'm down to 3 minutes. Let me.
Could I ask a question? Please. Would unconscionability analysis apply to other provisions of the covenants, conditions, and restrictions by a home buyer, setting aside the arbitration clause, could a home buyer in defense of the CC&Rs or a provision in the CC&Rs assert unconscionability?
Excuse me, Your Honor. If I understand your question, the answer is yes. Unconscionability is a defense to be used against any provisions in the contract. That's my understanding. And CC&Rs are treated like contracts, and if there is another provision in the CC&Rs that is hidden somewhere in the CC&Rs, it's not well displayed, or for some substantive reason it's not conscionable, then I think that doctrine would apply that. I don't think it's just an arbitration provision rule.
So I'm making that assumption. Would that distinguish it from the case Justice Gibbons mentioned at the outset of argument?
Let me talk about that. We're kind of a Kindred Nursing Center case. I'm not sure it makes a difference, the unconscionability analysis. There, in that case, the Justice Kagan was very severe in smacking down the Kentucky Supreme Court for adopting a legislative rule that disfavored arbitration. And in that ruling, the Justice Kagan cited Concepcion, which is the case that is really seems to be pushing this idea that you cannot treat arbitration provisions differently. Cites Concepcion in the cases after Concepcion, and it emphasizes again that you cannot pick out arbitration provisions. In that case, the case that came out last month, the court created a rule that if you have a power of attorney, and if that power of attorney designee wants to go into an arbitration division, you need some special rule on top of that. That is a judicial creation that picks an arbitration. And so I think the way I read that case is that the unconscionability analysis does apply, and that they were, well, I'm not sure, I take that back. They did not get to the unconscionability analysis because they ruled that you are violating the FAA by creating rules that disfavor arbitration. Creating a hostility towards arbitration that's just not allowed.
You're going to reserve the rest of your time?
What's that?
You're going to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, please.
Mr. Schimmick, on behalf of the respondents.
May it please the court. Over 20 years ago, the legislature enacted Chapter 40 as a public purpose, to restore residential construction to minimum standards in Nevada. That public purpose was also recited in the Gonski opinion, where it said Chapter 40 is enacted for a public purpose. What we have here today is a question of, can that public statute be contravened or eliminated by a private agreement, either in the sales agreement or the CC&Rs created by the developer? That's the overall question. And I think the answer should be no. We understand that arbitration provisions cannot be put in a lower or disfavored provision, but neither should they be put in a superior position. Arbitration provisions in a sales contract or CC&Rs cannot be given more weight than any other type of contract provisions. And I think that's useful when we talk about...
How do you square that with the requirement in D.R. Horton and Gonski of conspicuousness? It seems to me if you're saying an arbitration provision to be enforceable must be conspicuous, conspicuousness is a relative term relative to everything else in the contract. So certainly to that extent, you are singling it out.
The doctrine of unconscionability and its the aspect of conspicuousness is true for any contract, whether we call it a sales contract or a contract principle applied to a CC&R. So it is not singled out, it simply applies the same principles of unconscionability that would apply to any contract. We've seen that in...
But there's numerous provisions. There's attorney's fees, there's integration clauses, there's all kinds of things. Conspicuousness, how can one clause be more conspicuous than the other and not be singled out?
The principle applies to each term of that contract.
So everything has to be conspicuous?
In terms of what the unconscionability doctrine says, that's one of the factors, but it also goes into how clear it is, how confusing it is. If there is some opportunity to negotiate or not negotiate, is there some opportunity to revise some of the terms? So it's not just a one-factor issue. And that is important because in terms of this case, it's basically there's no meaningful distinction between this case and the Gonski case or the Green case. The stack of papers is the same. The location of the various terms are very similar. One of the Lennar provisions, the 9-page version of the sales agreement, has the poison pill term, where anybody who contests the arbitration provision shall have fees against awarded against them. So it's like the penalty phase in the Gonski case, penalty term in the Gonski case. So that doctrine of unconscionability has all these aspects. It's not limited just to conscionability.
In Chapter 40, do you contend that the arbitration agreements in this case, whether in the CC&Rs or in the purchase agreements, eliminate or render unenforceable?
There is a list. Let's start with the very definition of defect. The defect definition in the statute has a history to it. Building code violations, industry standards, that's sort of the manufacturer requirements. Where does the CC&R start with? It starts with its first what's a defect that uses, quote, a quality that's consistent with construction and development practices for production housing of this type. Where's the definition of a defect there? It's
but
gone.
Does it say that chapter, my understanding is that it says chapter 40 applies to the extent required by law, correct? Or am I mistaken in that?
It gives it one hand, it takes away with the other. There are four different definitions of defect in these CCNRs.
But in answer to the question, doesn't it say that chapter 40 applies?
It says that chapter 40 applies, and then it says that there's a conflict between chapter 40 and the CCNRs prevail.
So only to the extent permitted by law, correct?
I can't recall the exact phrase at that point, but what we need to look, I think, at what the court asked me the question of what are the differences, what is been removed from chapter 40 in the CCNRs.
Yeah.
One is the defect. There are four definitions of defect. One is the production hazard thing I mentioned. The next, it defines alleged defects as those things that are negligent in the construction. The third definition is it must fall within the express written warranty of the developer's own created warranty part of it. And then the fourth definition is the reference to Chapter 40 in the Construction Defect Act. So it has four definitions of construction defect within the CCNRs. Then we go to the provision the court mentioned about, well, doesn't it say only incorporate Chapter 40 to the extent permitted by law? Well, where are we left with now? In terms of procedural unconscionability and the confusing nature of this document, we have homeowners to guess as to what's the definition of defect. It goes beyond that point. It goes beyond it because it provides three different types of notices that a homeowner must provide. One is the initial notice of this alleged defect that's negligent. The next notice, that's to the developer. The next notice is a notice under their express limited warranty. The next notice is the Chapter 40 notice itself. The next notice is after repairs, a homeowner is to give a notice to the developer of what was not cured. And then there is one additional notice, pre-arbitration notice, that the homeowner is to provide that tells the developer what they have to do to resolve the dispute. So we have gone from the Chapter 40 notice provision, which provides a fair amount of detail and the procedures that are there, to now an additional set of burdens on the homeowner, both for guessing what the defect is and then for providing the notice. Then we get to the question of costs and fees.
Of what?
The question of costs and fees that are provided for under Chapter 40. As they are now, it is intended to make the homeowner whole, that the provision is, in effect, a one-way provision, that homeowners are allowed to claim costs and fees so that an interest in loss of use, so that the net amount should be enough to repair the construction. We've changed that in this CCNR provisions. We changed it to being each party bear their own fees and costs, each party bear their own arbitration costs.
But it says unless otherwise recoverable by law or statute, each party shall bear its own costs and fees. That's the problem I'm having here, is that it's always a deference to the statute. So if that's the case, the arbitrator would be required, unless you're going to get manifest disregard of the law and later review of the ARB decision, to apply them. Wrong with that?
I believe, Your Honor, that the difference is that it's discretionary with the arbitrator, and then when the conflict comes between the CCNR provisions and the Chapter 40, the CCNR provisions prevail.
Well, how could it be discretionary when it expressly says they're referring to the statute as the source of the entitlement?
You know, I think let's compare it to the Pinnacle case. To the Pinnacle case,
okay,
on the homeowner association case, where the court said these were approved by the Department of Real Estate through the California Code of Regulations. But the provision that comes into play there is that those regulations actually have a provision under 2891.8, subsection 6, that says they can have an alternative dispute resolution as long as all the available remedies and rights are exercised under the statute. And even in the CCNRs itself, this is, when we talk about Pinnacle, it's interesting to compare these CCNRs with this Pinnacle CCNRs. Pinnacle starts out with construction disputes, bold, capitalized, underlined. Section 18.3, resolution of constructive dispute by arbitration, whatever the number on. What did VCCNR say? Something called media arbitration of disputes. No heading about construction, no heading about alternative resolution. You have to dig down into the middle of 25.3 to find even the reference to the Construction Defect Act, the Chapter 40 provision. Even the dispute paragraph, or the dispute sentence, let me say that. The dispute sentence has 235 words, 51 punctuation points, and that's going to be something that is clear to a homeowner, even if they were to read the CCNRs. Let's go on to Pinnacle. Pinnacle says, under 18.3G, there's a waiver of jury trial and right to appeal. To get to that in the Lamar CCNRs, you have to dig down into 25.3D, where there's a waiver of jury only if the arbitration is unenforceable. No statement about appeal. Even more in the Pinnacle, paragraph 2 at the beginning of this thing says, it refers to section 18, quote, refers to mandatory procedures for the resolution of construction defect disputes, including the waiver of the right to jury trial for such disputes, unquote. There's no kind of heads up section in the CCNRs that Lamar and KB put together. Further, later on, in section, the same section, it says, the arbitrator is authorized to provide all recognized remedies available to law or inequity for any cause of action, unquote. And the court in Pinnacle quoted at length the code of regulation that says you have to provide the same remedies, and then acknowledged in the opinion that the developer said, they wrote it specifically, so that every kind of remedy available in law or inequity was still available. On those terms, the Lennar KB CCNRs are silent.
What remedies do you contend are not available in arbitration to you in this case?
The remedies that under their CCNRs are not available are the costs, the fees, the definition, the settled definition of construction defect, the limitation notices to the initial notice, the remedy of, at the end of repairs, the developer is obligated to send a letter to the homeowner saying, we fixed 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, so that the homeowner can provide that to a future homeowner, a future buyer, to get some sense of what was done. All those are gone. And the reason I...
Again, if that's violative of statute, how can it be gone?
Because if they wanted to do that, they could have said it. They could have said, if there was a conflict between these CCNRs, then Chapter 40 would prevail. They did not. They did it the opposite. They did it the opposite because every provision in the CCNRs is one side. All the obligations to the claimants are there, and new ones, and added ones, but the obligations to the defense are done. They're not in there. They're not in there for a reason, because this section was intended to get around Chapter 40. That's what it was intention. And it wasn't just a neutral form shift like we might expect in the Pinnacle case. It's not a pure form shift from this form to that form. It is to a different form with worse rules, with the construction industry rules that's composed of contractors and lawyers for contractors.
So you would say then, if the order were reversed and the case was compelled to arbitration, your position would be that you have no entitlement to costs and fees, that the arbitrator should say you get no costs and fees?
No, if the provision were reversed to say there's a conflict.
No, listen to my question for a moment. You say that the arbitration agreement takes away your right to costs and fees under Chapter 40, correct?
Yes.
If that's true, then you would agree with me that if this court reverses and says this case needs to go to arbitration, you would stipulate that in arbitration you have no right to costs and fees?
It's not a right under the CCNRs. Unless this court were to say,
your position is you have no legal entitlement if you go to arbitration to costs and fees. Isn't that what you're saying?
The position is, it's a coin toss between the arbitrator to decide fees and costs.
Again, if the statute mandates costs and fees, and the arbitrator, you're saying it's a discretionary matter and doesn't follow the statute.
Then you have manifest disregard under Chapter 38, which is the arbitration review provisions. I mean, I'm at a loss here.
If the court's opinion were to reverse this decision and send it to arbitration.
And I'm not saying that's what we're doing. I'm trying to have a conversation.
And if we're accompanied by a provision that says, these can proceed, but all Chapter 40 rights and remedies need to be available, that is an option to the court. Because Chapter 40 is not inherently inconsistent with arbitration.
Right, that's my thought.
It is not inherently inconsistent. That's why the Kindred case is different in terms of the jury rights and so forth. It is different. Chapter 40 is not inherently inconsistent with arbitration. And Nevada has a policy by itself in favor of
it. And if it's not inconsistent with arbitration, then there's nothing substantively unconscionable about sending a Chapter 40 case to arbitration inherently.
With direction, if I might add, to say that the Chapter 40 provisions cannot...
Then you get into who's supposed to make those decisions. But yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. King, take 2 minutes.
Yes. Very quickly, I wanted to point out, going back to what Justice Douglas raised for the FAA, the parties stipulated that the FAA would apply. So I wanted to put that on there.
Can they stipulate to choice of law like that where public policy is implicated?
I believe that stipulations that the FAA applies have been enforced. I think that's what this court did in the Tallman case. So I would say yes. But the problem I have is that there seems to be this assumption by the homeowners that the arbitrator is not going to follow the law. I appreciate this, the quote by the Supreme Court, which says there's no reason to assume at the outset that arbitrators will not follow the law. Arbitrators have to follow the law, and they will follow the law under Chapter 40. I've said before, last year, I'm saying it again, U.S. Home is not trying to avoid Chapter 40. The parties went through Chapter 40. Chapter 40 is completed. We are now in the litigation phase, and we're just simply moving the litigation to arbitration where it should be. All of the Chapter 40 rights, the rights to fees and costs, are intact.
So you concede, reversing the question that I was asking Mr. Schinnett, you concede that they are entitled to fees and costs, correct?
Absolutely.
Under Chapter 40, under those rules?
Yes, we have maintained that consistent. Mr. Schinnett quoted a part of the CC&Rs from the Pinnacle Hill case. It's the exact same provision that's in our case. The arbitrator shall be authorized to provide all recognized remedies available in law or in equity. That is in our CC&Rs. Unless you have any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for their arguments. This matter and the briefs filed. This matter stands submitted.